Shares. Market.
The S&P.
The ASX.
Stocks.
This is Motley Fool Money.
Welcome to Motley Fool Money, the podcast that is possibly part of a country that is rich, dumb, and getting dumber. Okay. I'm Scott Phillips, and with me, as always, Dr. Anirban Mahanty. G'day, Doc. How are you, mate?
I'm good, mate. How are you?
Which one are you, mate? Rich, dumb, or getting dumber?
I don't know. Maybe all of them.
I'll give you first dibs, and I'll have the second one. No, we are going to talk about that. That's a headline, a very evocative, very interesting headline in the AFR. That's a reasonably, as I said, provocative way to explain it. The basis was a Harvard Business School, I want to say. Bit of research. Maybe it's Harvard University. One of the two. Same thing. Basically saying Australia's got some issues. We'll talk about that. We will talk about the big V. Volatility is back with a vengeance in the markets. Is it time to break up the big four banks? One person certainly thinks so, although someone else says no. And we'll talk about, not just Doc and I, other people, real people, proper people with proper, you know, credentials and media savvy and all that kind of stuff. And we will dip into the full mailbag. What do you reckon, mate? Should we get going?
Let's get going.
Let's do it.
Motley Fool Money. For more, go to fool.com.au/MMM.
Mate, I'll start with the macro.
I was going to say, you interrupted me.
Go on.
Yeah, because you said, you know, people with credentials. Like, I've got some credentials too. Like, what about my credentials?
We don't get quoted in the media. Actually, I did today.
Oh, well, there we go.
I finally arrived.
So therefore, you have credentials.
My random tweet, well, credential singular, maybe. I think we can't go plural just yet.
Yeah. One credence. Some credence. That almost sounds like, you know, we're into Harry Potter or something.
I think Credence Clearwater Revival.
Yeah.
Bit of music?
Yeah.
Oh, I'll do that. Maybe our next episode should be a music special.
Yeah. You're going to sing, right?
And you play guitar.
Okay.
Deal?
That sounds really...
Don't unsubscribe. I'm kidding. All right. Mate, that is about the most random tangent we've ever started with.
Yeah, sometimes we do that.
We need to start talking.
It's a nice and bright sunny day. So.
It is actually Wednesday too. For those of you who are listening to this on a Friday, we're recording this on Wednesday the 9th of October. If something happens tomorrow or the day after, we're sorry we're not covering it. I'm going to be, hopefully, if the weather holds, out camping somewhere, out of mobile range with all likelihood, and certainly out of podcast range. So we're here on a Wednesday. As I said, if something goes wrong the next day or two, don't blame us. We'll be back to talk about it next week instead. Mate, let's get to it somehow. I mentioned the big V as we started. Volatility is well and truly back. The last week, Wednesday, Thursday, the market was down, I want to say, 3% across those 2 days. Overnight, Tuesday night, Australian time, Wednesday morning, the US market had a reasonably ordinary night. All the big indices were down. There's so much going on, mate. Trade talks, economic growth, some issues with China geopolitically. What do you kind of make of what's going on the last couple of weeks market-wise? Is this, you know, a sign of things to come? Is it business as usual? What's going on?
Oh, well, I was going to say, you know, I'm happy some days and I'm unhappy some other days.
Now, are you the sort of guy who's happy when the market's down because you get to buy things cheaper, or you're unhappy because your portfolio is worthless?
Well, I hope my portfolio is not worthless.
When the market's down, though, that's what I mean.
Because the wife would kick me out.
But if you have a bad day, do you wake up and go, I've had a bad day? Do you go, oh, at least the market's down, I can buy stuff cheaper?
So on one of those days, you know, it's, again, very natural. It happens. Like if I look at the portfolio, which I think looking at it, it's always the starting point of the problem. then, you know, like on a nice green positive day, you know, you see the account balance has gone up and you feel good about it. And then, you know, on a nice red negative day, you know, like let's say this morning, almost all markets are actually down. You feel like, you know, well, you know, that virtual wealth kind of has decreased, right? I think it has a bit of a psychological impact, I think.
Yeah. It has to, right? It's hard not to.
Yeah, it's only natural. And like for most people, you know, the pain of loss is more than the, you know, the joy of gain. So so that does impact. I mean, but you do. You keep focus and think about the fact that, you know, these are still the same companies. Nothing has really changed. You know, the geopolitical situation, it keeps doing its thing. Such things happen all the time. And in the markets overall, if you take it, you know, zoom out, then they basically go up because, again, as I like to say, you know, it's a bet on human ingenuity and that human beings as a group like to make progress. And that's how you kind of participate in the progress is by basically buying stocks in companies.
Mm.
So, it's part of the...
So it makes you unhappy but not pessimistic? Is that a fair way to describe it?
Yeah, like I'm unhappy, but I'm not pessimistic in the sense I'm not rushing to sell. So the one thing that I do not do is I don't rush to sell when everybody else wants to sell. That would be stupid.
Right. And there's a lesson there, right, in separating the emotion from the action. Like we all want to be sort of Dr. Spock or Mr. Spock, I should say, in Star Trek and not feel the emotions at all and be able to kind of take it all equanimity, feel okay about ups and downs. That's kind of unreasonable. The next best thing we can do is say, well, I feel this way, but my actions have to be filtered through another lens. And if we can do that, well, that maybe is the best we can hope for.
Yeah, I think that's a good way to put it. Like basically, yeah, you have to separate what you do from how you feel. And I mean, you know, it's hard to control the feelings. Overall, I mean, it'd be great if you actually can control the feelings too. I mean, you should. I mean, if you can. And that's something that, you know, you can over time actually improve. Yeah. Like, I think over time it's improved a bit
for me.
That's
a good point.
It's worth it. You know, there are tricks like don't open the portfolio, don't look at it, don't read the news, and things like that. But yeah, you know, like most days you actually should have nothing to do because, I mean, you know, you don't have money every day to invest. So, like, I mean, what do you really need to open your account for, right? You know what I mean?
Right, right.
There has been no, I mean, if the companies have no earnings report and there's been no major news release, then, I mean, there's no reason, again, to do something, right? So, on most days, you basically do nothing. And if you're doing nothing, you don't have to open your brokerage account to just feel miserable, right?
Right. I mean, and so, funnily enough, I've traveled a couple of times to the US for work in the last few years. And I've got to say, it really struck me each time how different it is to go to bed and then wake up, go to bed before the market opens and wake up after the market closes. The whole idea that I couldn't do anything about it even if I wanted to, the whole idea that I'm effectively only checking my portfolio at most once a day, because if I go to bed before the market opens, wake up after it's closed, I can kind of go and check the damage or the hopefully the good news. But that's all I can do. And so it's a really, really strange feeling. If you can check your portfolio at 10:30, then 12:30, and maybe again at 12:31 because you're worried, and then 12:32 because you're bored and... excuse me, and then, you know, 2 o'clock and 2:30 and 3 o'clock, and you know, it can be a real emotional roller coaster, or just simply straight an emotional kind of, again, either lifts your mood or it wrecks it. But when you're literally forced to be outside the market, we also say to people, and I don't check my portfolio a lot when I'm in Australia, to be fair, I very rarely open it during the day, actually. Sometimes I do. But the whole, just that change of geography, change of mindset, literally change of time zone, has an amazing impact on my emotions. If you can just, as you say, not bother opening the portfolio at all, check it once after market close if you feel like it. But it's a really big difference in terms of how you approach investing and how you feel about it.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, I have nothing really to add to that. I mean, I think that's all, like, you know, very valid. I think you train your mind, look at your portfolio less often,
right,
and
right.
Don't equate, I think, you know, volatility to requirement of action, right? I mean, you know, if stuff becomes really cheap for some reason, then yes, you want to buy. That makes a lot of sense. But if you have no, like, you know, like, I don't have money every day to invest. So therefore, what is the point of really opening the brokerage?
And I've got to say that, I mean, that's the whole of you can't do anything about it anyway. That is exactly the opposite of the brokerage ads you'll see around the place. Like, you know, thankfully, we don't have any investment banking relationships. We don't have any stockbroker relationships. So we get to say whatever we want. You won't normally see that elsewhere. The whole, and I won't name them because I don't want a lawsuit, but the bloody take a position, you know, be smart. You can do this. You can beat the market, you know. Trade and be successful. That kind of that whole sort of psychological, I don't know what you call it, manipulation, basically, that kind of tries to tell you, hey, you know, plays on your arrogance, plays on your sense of control, your sense of ego, your sense of kind of, you know, intellect. Hey, you're smart, you can do this, go on, have a go, do it. That's why they make their money, right? They make their money on trading. It's the only thing where, you know, well, not the only thing, one of the very few ways where they get paid not on whether you're successful or not, just simply on how much activity goes through your trading account. And that's one of those really important things to do. While everyone out there is saying, trade more. Bloody ComSec, I'm a customer. They give you eight trades a month, you get access to some fancy research platform. Cost them nothing to provide. Do eight trades. Well, that's eight trades at 20, 30 bucks.
Mm.
I mean, you know, would you pay $200 a month for a particular trading platform? Probably not.
Mm.
If it's free because you make eight trades, well, that's all. You know, those psychological tricks are really, really important. Mm. ComSec, I love you. Don't sue me. But you've really got to just think very carefully about what you're being incentivized to do and how the market, even the $60 million, $60 billion wiped off market headlines, same kind of idea, right? It all compels us to feel like we should do something. And quite often the answer is do nothing.
Yeah, $60 billion out of a $1.8 trillion market cap. I think that's the way to think about it, right?
Exactly. It's a nothing number. It's a nonsense number. It's real.
It's daily volatility.
Yeah. Now, speaking of which, Matt, so let's get back to the markets. Lots of conversation. Is there stuff to worry about US here at home globally, or is it literally just action and volatility? I mean, you know, we start by saying, well, just volatility, but some people are saying, I've got tweets here that I've read, not directly to the mailbag, just in general, saying, you know, well, when the market crashes after 10 years of QE in the US and there's horrible, horrible times to come. I mean, there's a decent proportion of doom and gloomers out there who are saying that, you know, that somehow we've been inflating on a bubble of Reserve Bank or central bank goodness. I mean, that goes away, that we're going to hell in a handbasket. That's ever present, but should we start thinking about maybe this isn't just volatility, maybe this is something worse?
Well, I mean, does anybody really know, right? I mean, it's one of those things where if I can, you know, if I predict that the market is going to crash sometime in the future, I will definitely be right. Because sometime in the future it's going to crash.
Yep.
Or it's going to, you know, have a pullback or whatever you want to call it.
Yep.
I don't know. Like, I mean, the low interest rates are, like, seem very real. And they're at, you know, various parts of the world, they're low for various different reasons, right? Mm-hmm. But they are low. If you think about it, can it continue being low? Well, look at Japan. It has been really low for a long time.
Right.
It can be low for a long, long time.
Yeah.
Does that mean that, you know, maybe the stocks are not going to have, you know, in all likelihood, stocks might not have the kind of returns they've had over the past 10 years. And the reason for that would not be that, you know, the economies around the world suck. It's just that, you know, when you have like a big correction,
right,
like, you know, it is, the other explanation is that stuff just became really cheap and you had an opportunity to ride the cheap wave to it becoming fairly valued, right? I mean, so that's the other side of the argument. With all that said, I mean, it's very difficult to predict, like, when a big correction will happen, if that's what, you know, and there's no reason to believe that you have a 10-year bull run, doesn't mean that the bull run can't continue for another 10 years, another 5 years, another day, right? Again, nobody knows. Are there things to worry about? Lots of things to worry about, but there are lots of things to worry about all the time. There are things to worry about the trade wars. There are things to worry about anemic growth. There are things to worry about, you know, how tech is impacting jobs. But then at the same time, you could say, you know, there are other things you can be very happy about. You can say how tech and every other thing is making your quality of life better. How, you know, we might be going to the moon, to Mars, how we might be actually mining, you know, the outer universe, you know, all those things, you know, how we might have, you know, internet from space and things like that, you know, how we might solve, you know, rare disease issues and so on. So there's lots of, you know, there's pluses and minuses everywhere. So I don't know. I mean, yeah, so I don't see that, it again, there's nothing obvious that, and if something was obvious, the market would have already crashed, right? Or corrected or whatever.
Yeah.
Does that mean that the market would not pull back by 10% or maybe 20%? If that happens, it's actually happened. Again, the 10, 20, 15%, 20% pullbacks, they do happen, and they've happened, you know, over the past 10 years, they've happened a number of times. So
I guess that's the question though, right? So for all that positivity, and just to be devil's advocate for our listeners, that's all true. It doesn't mean that, say, in 1999 we had the massive tech crash, or in 2007 we had the market pullback. Those things are undoubtedly true, and I am in 100% agreement. In fact, not even indiscriminate at all about any of it. But to be devil's advocate for a second, what if all that's true but the market is still overvalued? You know, how do you, why not just wait and see?
Yeah, so for the number one thing, so first of all, I'll separate this into two parts. The .com stuff, where you could put a .com in front of anything, pet.com, and it all of a sudden became highly valuable. Many of these businesses had no revenue, like zero revenue, and they were on crazy multiples.
Mm.
Is that sort of thing happening today? In parts, there are certain parts of the market where a certain business might have, like, you know, less than a few million dollars of revenue, even a few hundred thousand dollars of revenue, and it's like valued at gazillion times that. That I would question. And, you know, there's a lot of, you know, momentum trading and whatnot going on there. You know, the price is increasing, therefore somebody's piling in. And because somebody, you know, piled in, your friend piled in, therefore my friend piled in, and therefore, you know, their friend piled in, their brother, sister, everybody piled in, right? So that happens. But I'm not sure. I mean, that sort of stuff always happens. Is the degree of prevalence of that increased? Maybe. I don't know. By and large, though, some parts of the market are expensive, some are not. I would say this. I would say that nothing looks obviously cheap.
Yeah.
But that doesn't mean that there are no opportunities, right? And then the other thing to consider is often we think about, the long-term average of the market is this.
Mm.
What we, I think, don't factor in that long-term average. Well, the long-term average was that with interest rates being at a certain level. And I think that has a big impact on how you sort of think about where money should go and how you should value things,
mm-mm,
right? So I think the long-term average was with, interest rate at 5% or 6% average versus now interest rate being like, what? It's in 0.75 in Australia, probably going to zero, right? So how do you you have to factor that in too. So I think there's that bit. So overall, I'm not saying that there are screaming bargains out there, but I think there are opportunities and pockets of opportunities and there's pockets of overvaluation and things like that.
And things are always so high, right? No matter how high you think they already are, it's generally speaking, historically, been a dangerous thing to try and time markets. Trying to predict downturns or slowdowns is just incredibly, incredibly difficult. Occasionally, you get it right. You only said to me this morning that there's a whole group of people who are, and I won't name any of them to save you from getting a lawsuit, who can be, rightly put in that pantheon of people who've been right once and have built, kind of entire careers out of it, without needing to be right multiple times and genuinely build a proper track record.
Yeah.
We kind of lionize those people and forget that over time the markets still go up 10% a year, more or less. As you say, depends on where you start from, but broadly speaking, it's a very dangerous thing to start from assuming things are going to go badly, because traditionally that's been a losing bet.
Yeah.
Let's move on, mate.
Value stocks.
Market.
Stock market.
Index.
Share market.
This is Motley Fool Money. Subscribe to the free newsletter at fool.com.au/MMM.
Speaking about losing bets, as I was, he says, trying to segue nicely from market volatility through to banking stocks. Mate, we don't talk about
that. That was not a great segue.
Wasn't it?
No.
What should I go with?
Just let's go straight to it.
Straight to it. All right. Yeah. We'll edit this back out later.
Yeah.
We won't. We never do. Mate, so the big four banks are in the news, as they always are. Most recently, they're paying thousands of dollars out in remediation for people they, can I say, ripped off? I probably can, because they didn't name a single individual bank, so they'll struggle to sue me. And they're kind of, making good on some of the things they've done wrong as a result of the Royal Commission, among other things. The interesting topic, though, is whether or not they are too big, not to fail, not to succeed, but too big to be a responsible part of our economy. There was an article in the AFR only today arguing for the big four banks to actually be broken up. Now, the term that they use in economic circles is economic rent, not rent as in paying for a property, but the amount of money you can make in profit above what you otherwise should be able to earn because of some structural benefits you're getting from a particular circumstance or economy. Now, that's where the term rent seeking comes from, if you've read that in the papers. And basically, the idea is if you're getting economic rent, then it's the circumstance or the result of a market that's not as competitive as it should be. And this particular banker, what's his name? Joseph Healy, who was ex-NAB and ex-ANZ, is saying they should be broken up, all the big four banks, because they simply have too much market power and are making too much money. Now, that's on one side of the article. On the other side of the coin, on the same day in the AFR, you can't accuse them of not being balanced. An article quoting Jeff Wilson from Wilson Asset Management saying the banks are actually okay and frankly shouldn't make any less money because strong banking sector, strong profitable banks that are kind of structurally sound and not economically risky are actually really important for our economy. So two different sides of the same coin. I don't own any bank stocks. You don't own any bank stocks. But what do we do, mate? Do we break them up because they're too big? Or do we say, well, they might make a lot of money, but that's kind of a worthwhile cost, if you like, a worthwhile expense for our economy if it means we're more structurally sound than otherwise would be?
Mate, that's a hard one. I mean, it's a hard
one.
That's
why I asked you, mate. I do the easy ones, mate. You get the hard ones.
Yeah, I noticed that. it's a hard one largely because I think I agree with both sides. Maybe I lean more towards the side that, you actually shouldn't break up the banks because I agree with the fact that a good banking sector is important for the economy. Strong banking sector, it gives confidence to the economy. We're a relatively small economy in terms of, number of people and so on and so forth. And, it makes sense if we have only four sort of big banks relative to our population, relative to, you know, the total economy output, I guess. Yeah, I mean, the situation could be that you'd have, you know, maybe you could have double those numbers or triple those number of banks, and then maybe there's more competition. But, you know, would those banks, I mean, the banks be healthy enough? You know, would we have a lot of, you know, banks that are basically on the edge, making less money?
Right.
And so on. I mean, I don't know. I rather...
You kind of want to be careful what you wish for, right? There's a... Oh, sorry, I'm going to half answer your question. Is it Nassim Taleb who wrote Anti-Fragile?
Yeah.
So the idea basically of Anti-Fragile is that you want to be careful that you're not so efficient, so kind of so lean. It's a bit like athletes, right? Athletes get crook really regularly.
Yes.
Because they don't, you know, have the same dietary and exercise habits of me, to be fair. And I get sick a lot less because I'm just not that finely, believe it or not, I'm not that finely tuned athlete who is so primed to do really, really well. It ends up kind of being fragile because the system is so engineered. There's not a lot of leeway, and that's great when it works. You set a marathon world record, and you're a genius, but you get sick and break down and do a knee or do an ankle or you know, somehow just get the flu more often because, you know, your body's just less able to resist that stuff. You kind of want to be careful what you wish for. Yeah, we all want to win a marathon, but at an economic level, do we want to risk the gold medal on the chance that actually the whole thing might come massively a cropper?
Yeah, I think the other thing that I think people miss, I guess, it almost seems like I'm defending the banks, which it sounds funny.
It's the first time for everything.
Yeah, it's the first time. I mean, the thing is that our banks are actually like on typical profitability measures, really profitable, right? You know, returns on equity, for example, are pretty high when you compare them to global standards. And that kind of makes sense because, you know, most of the things, the profits are pulled down because there's a lot of competition, and often competition comes from overseas and things like that, right? A, banking being regulated, and B, you know, it's a small market. It's not worthwhile for other people to jump into a highly regulated market, which is, in a way, reduces competition, right? I mean, highly regulated markets, there are going to be fewer competitors because, you know, why do I want to come into a market which is small? It's not going to add lots of value to, you know, an external competitor, right?
Right.
So I think for all of those reasons, I think, you know, in a way, it might be odd to expect more competition than actually what we have. And, you know, maybe it's like a bit of an oligopoly going on, or, you know, maybe cartel might be the wrong word.
you can make that claim. I'm not going to go
I'm not making any claims here about cartels. But I mean, overall, I think a good banking sector is useful. It's good. And, you know, should the banks pass on more of the rate cuts? Maybe. But again, it's one of those things, you know, do you want them to pass all the rate cuts and be very fragile, right? You know?
Exactly, right.
It's the balancing act, and, you know, they need to, and I think the banks here do a good job of trying to balance the various stakeholders, right? I mean, if they didn't pass on the rate as much as they potentially could, then, you know, there are, you know, non-bank lenders people would go to and people are going to. So anyways.
That's kind of the irony, right? Like in the last financial crisis, it was the non-bank lenders, the Wizards, the Rams, that actually went to the wall. Bank West got sold to Commonwealth Bank. I mean, at some point, we're kind of, if we'd been a country full of lean disruptors rather than kind of big profitable incumbents, the GFC might have gone meaningfully differently in Australia.
Exactly. I think, So, anyways, I think there's some interesting things about the size of the economy, right? And that's why we have in certain industries, we have, like, you know, maybe one or two or three or four major players. And if you look at even supermarkets, right, why don't we have a lot more competition in, for example, groceries, right?
Right.
Again, it's the structure of the economy and the size, I think, matters here.
So that was the other thing I wanted to ask you about, actually. You've beautifully done a seg for me, which I could have taken off, but instead of that, I'm going to talk about the seg instead of just going there because we're not that good and I'm not that professional. There is a tendency in economics generally, in economies generally, in industry, society, pick whatever term you want, for sectors, categories, industries to kind of become oligopolies, monopolies over time. There's four major airlines in the US. In the past, there would have been 20. There's two here in Australia. We've got two supermarket chains where in the past there was much, much more competition. There's two or three telcos. I mean, admittedly, we're a small economy, but all around the world, the bigger getting bigger and the smaller getting kind of squeezed out or taken over or shut down. At some point, there is something kind of structurally that needs to be addressed by regulators at some point, right? Just as a concept, how far do you go before there's two of everything, you know, a bit like Noah's Ark? Any industry, there's going to be two big guys. At some point, that gets to the point of being anti-competitive and does start to harm our economic well-being, our standard of living, doesn't it?
Well, I'm not too sure. I think that let's use airlines, and I don't know much about the U.S. airlines, so I'm going to make up some stuff here.
Again, that's my job, not yours.
As I'm wanting to do. But let's say there were 20 there, let's say, competing.
Yep.
Really, there was not enough money for those 20 to be made, right?
Oh, right, exactly.
And so
they
got, you know, the poorly run ones got squeezed. Yes. Now,
the consumer's the winner, though. That is the other thing, right? So we all flew for cheap.
Yeah, we're still flying for cheap, right? I mean, the thing is that if the four that exist, you know, jack up profits enough that there is room. I mean, capitalism, the moment there is enough profits to be made, somebody's going to try to jump in.
Yep.
So I think as long as that lever is there, and that might not happen in highly regulated areas because it's harder.
Right. Or where there's high barriers to entry, right? A lot of capital required or something kind of specific. I can't imagine starting a telco tomorrow. Like, it'd be pretty hard to kind of, for you and I to get together and raise a few bucks and put some 5G towers up around the country.
Yeah, I think so. Those are hard. Like, you know, I think, you know, organizations like, you know, or bodies like ACCCA, for example, do a good job there trying to make sure that there's enough competition and, you know, don't have enough mergers and acquisitions and or whatnot happening to sort of safeguard the consumer's interest, right? And I'm not taking a position here about or the ongoing discussion, but I'm just saying that there is an active ACCC that looks into this. The same story might be true, you know, maybe for the size of Australia, two airlines are more than enough, and maybe there's Rex, right? It's a regional outfit. So we have that, and you know, maybe that's enough. And if you think about it, from an airline point of view, even, and I'm digressing, right? There's international competition as well, right? So when you think there are two airlines for domestic travel, but there are hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of airlines when you want to fly internationally, right? And there's a lot of competition. In some cases, the airlines are subsidized by government because the government considers the airlines as a way to, you know, support tourism, right? So there's a whole host of other things. So, I believe that ultimately, the profit motive is there.
Yeah.
And when I think there's enough profits being made, some other third party would try to come in, you know. And somebody's margin is basically, you know, somebody else's opportunity. And I think that's always true.
Yeah. You've said before, just to kind of tease that a little bit more, and I hope I'm not giving anything away here, but I'm pretty sure you've said it publicly. You expect the kind of next range of, I'll probably paraphrase you here badly, so correct me. The next lot of innovations are going to come not from the small guys in the garages, but from the big guys who are already pretty dominant. I think if I'm not misquoting you, at some point that seems to me like an acceptance, even, you know, not necessarily explicitly, but implicitly, that these markets are kind of too hard now, or too big, or too complex, or too something, for little guys to have much of a chance of innovating meaningfully. Am I drawing too long a bow here? Am I misquoting you, or have I got it roughly right?
Well, you know, somewhere about there. I mean, and the thing is, maybe the best way to think about it, that in certain areas, the amount of money, dollars that you need for R&D, the skill set, the type of people that you need to hire. So basically, as things become more complex, right, it becomes harder to do that complexity innovation in the garage.
Yes.
And therefore, the big technology firms or big firms have an advantage there because they can pour, you know, their massive profits into massive R&Ds.
Yep.
Which basically disadvantages other people. Does that mean that other people are not going to be doing stuff? They will be doing stuff, but in certain areas, it's just going to be harder. The flip side is that there's not just one big company. Mm-hmm. Like, there are many big companies which are very big. You know, it's a subjective measure, right? But, I mean, there are lots of companies that are generating tens of billions of dollars of profit, right? And they can all invest in, and we see that. Like, you know, today, if you think about voice computing wars, there is, like, you know, Amazon has something, Microsoft has got something, Google has got something, Apple has got something. It's not that one company owns that field.
Mm-hmm.
There's enough competition.
Yeah, right? But it's all coming from the existing group or people who can kind of grow from large to very large, or can move sideways a little bit, rather than maybe the garage innovation we're used to.
Yeah. I think a lot of complex areas are basically out of bounds for smaller people because it's just the amount of investment required to do things is just harder.
All right, mate. I'm going to be controversial.
All right.
Real money advice from real people. Not just a couple of dicks with a Porsche. Get more at fool.com.au/MMM.
Australia is rich, dumb, and getting dumber. So say the boffins at Harvard. It was in the AFR yesterday, and this is a great, I love this. So Aaron Patrick was the journo from the AFR who wrote this. He says, Bangladesh, Cuba, Iran, Mali, and Turkmenistan share an unexpected connection to Australia, and it isn't membership of a tourist destination hot list. All are among the economies that are so lacking in complexity and have such limited natural opportunities to develop new products that Harvard University recommends they adopt industrial policy straight out of the post-colonial developing world, the, quotes, strategic bets approach. That's a very, very good opening couple of paragraphs. There's also an accompanying graph, and it's ranking of economic complexity. Number one is Japan. Number 12 is the US. I won't ask you where Australia ranks because I know you've seen it. Australia ranks under Senegal and above Pakistan at number 93. Now, I had a slight dig at that on Twitter, but before I get to that, you're less critical of this than I am. Basically, what it's saying is our economy is simply way, way too concentrated. It doesn't have enough complexity, enough kind of different ranges of industries and opportunities. And I'm kind of paraphrasing here because I'm not a Harvard academic. But broadly speaking, there's you know, some risk, some concern that we simply don't have enough complexity in our economy, and we should be doing something, making some strategic bets as a country to try and broaden out our economic base.
Yeah, so I mean the headline is by design is a brilliant headline in terms getting people to click, right?
Yeah, which is it worked.
I actually don't disagree at all with the. This might sound. So I don't want to make it sound bad, but I want to clarify one thing.
Yeah.
What this is measuring is exactly what they've said. It's measuring complexity right. in the economy, or in a way, it's measuring how advanced your economy is from an export point of view.
Yes. Now, let me give some stats here. It says the eighth richest nation in the study, i.e. Australia, has the export profile of Angola. About 70% of products sold to foreign buyers are minerals and energy. If we add in food, alcohol, wool, tourism, and metal, the figure rises to 99%. That's not exactly a broad range of exports.
Yeah, exactly. So I think that's what it is. So it's not talking about Human Development Index. We rank very highly there. It's not talking about, you know, quality of life index.
Standard of living.
Right. But I think what this is saying is that Australia has hinged its bandwagon on digging the ground and, you know, rearing the cows, basically.
From the sheep's back to the mining truck's bed, I think,
And in a way, I've said this many times, and I'm saying that what I think this is basically saying that we are not an innovation economy in any shape and form, which is dangerous. Because if a rich country like Australia is not an innovation economy, then we don't have a problem today. Even maybe in 50 years, we don't have a problem.
Right.
But it doesn't, you know, over, you know, multiple decades, there is very good reason to believe that this is going to result in overall, in 50 years, maybe in 100 years, a decay in quality of life from very high quality life to maybe slightly high, less high, and so on and so forth. That's number one. I think the other bigger, I guess here's the other thing, right? If most of your money is made by digging the ground, you're basically a price taker, right? You're a price taker for most of the stuff that's being sold.
Absolutely.
Like, you know, 14.2% is coal, which is basically on the way out. Iron ore is 14.5%. 12.2% is like petroleum.
And we're on record as not loving price-taking companies. So as an economy, we should be similarly critical of
price
an economy that's built basically where you don't have a say over how much price you can get for your products. And you just got to hope like hell that prices stay high. Otherwise, it can meaningfully impact your economic activity.
Yeah, let me paint a picture here, right? So a lot of these things that we are sending out are available in places like Democratic Republic of Congo. The problem is it's hard to dig from there because there's like, you know, there's chaos there. But, you know, if, for example, a lot of Africa all of a sudden became less chaotic, we'd have a problem. We'd have like a huge problem.
Right.
Like, because it'll be cheaper to dig in Congo than to dig here.
Mm-hmm.
And I think what that is saying, is effectively, you know, what are we doing about that? ICT is 4% of our economy. That's a problem.
Yep. Now, it's interesting that, I mean, to some degree, we just talked about fragility earlier, and this is kind of the exact definition of that, right? If our very few things that we do well and do profitably and do successfully and do reasonably dominantly, if they continue, we're sweet as a nut. You know, there is a story that in 50 years' time, Australia is the most prosperous country on earth per head of population because we have so much in the way of raw materials, minerals, tourism, etc., and we can charge a good price for those because scarcity or scale or something else lets us make money. There is one version of the future where Australia is among, if not at the top of, standards of living per capita. On the other hand, as you say, there's a scenario where either our minerals aren't required, i.e. coal, or it can be dug up cheaper elsewhere, or simply geopolitics changes things, and we could be meaningfully plunged down those economic well-being measures from exactly that kind of scenario, right?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you know, like Jeff Bezos is working on basically doing mining in the space, right? So when mining in the space becomes, you know, is it 20 years? I don't know. Is it in 15 years? I don't know. Is it in 10 years? I don't know, yeah. Right? But if that happens, maybe people will be getting iron ore from the space and not from Australia. And then we've got a problem. So I think all this is basically saying, I mean, I'm, you know, for all the headline is crazy because it doesn't talk about all the other things, but it does point to a problem and, you know, it's something that people should consider.
It's a risk, right? Now, Matt, I'm going to ask you a question I've said before. And I struggle with this. I was going to tweet about this actually earlier today, so it's great you mentioned it. You talk about ICT, so information communications technology. How did I go?
Very good.
Good, ICT. Medical, we do okay with, I guess. We've got Cochlear, ResMed, CSL. We probably punch above our weight, at least on an economic scale in medical technology. Would that be fair? Nanosonics, I suppose, we could throw into that mix.
Yeah, we do actually reasonably well, better to some others. But, you know, it doesn't show up in this number, actually, which is interesting. Because here's the other thing to remember, right? I mean, CSL, if it's doing bulk of its business abroad, it wouldn't actually show up here.
Right. So there's a big difference between what generates jobs and what generates kind of wealth or profits, right? So most CSL's profits are earned overseas, which is wonderful if you're a shareholder, probably good for the corporate, you know, government coffers, the corporate tax coffers probably are nicely swelled by CSL's profitability. They're all good things. Doesn't do a lot for jobs. And maybe that's part of a question we need to answer. You're a big bet R&D kind of guy. I kind of conceptually agree with you, but I have to say, if you made me treasurer tomorrow, frankly, we'd all leave the country, but let's assume people sat around. And someone said, the Prime Minister said to me, mate, how much should we spend on R&D? I don't know how I could reasonably pick a number to say, well, this might, you know, if we halved it or doubled it, could I draw a graph and say, well, if we double it or halve it, this is the kind of per dollar impact of the change. I don't know how, and that's kind of the point of this research, right, was that strategic bets idea was, they're basically saying the government should pick some stuff and invest behind it and try and be, in theory, the best in the world or at least a decent exporter in that space. If I'm treasurer tomorrow and I say, Doc, I want you to be my treasury advisor on R&D, and I want you to kind of give me a sense of how much, how could I go about, not even how much in dollars, because it's a silly question, but how do I go about working out how much I should spend on R&D? How do you kind of frame that up if you're in charge of that?
Well, so I think there's a place to look at, and that's the place to look at is China. So basically, if you look at the ranking of China on that graph in 2007 versus now, you'll see that has moved up significantly, right?
Right, right.
And there's a very simple way. I think this is actually, if I have to point to one place, which, you know, one region where Australia actually does poorly, and it has historically been the case, is the Australia's investment in the education sector is actually poor.
Oh man, it drives me nuts.
Right. It's so what you don't have to give tax. Actually, you know, giving tax breaks, R&D tax breaks, is just one part of it. You know, that that's basically money moving from one hand to the other hand, and you know,
right.
So, you know, you should. There's no reason to not have basically one of the world's best education sectors in this country, largely because you should be able to get some of the best academics to come here. Right, if they're not here.
On the basis of what? How much we pay them, the lifestyle we offer them? How do you do that?
I mean, we pay really well. We have a really good lifestyle here. Again, so those are really attractive qualities, okay. Right? So maybe you do it in partnership. But, you know, like I point to China, right? What China did is China built basically dual degree programs with top American schools and top other schools in the world.
Okay.
And basically trained a whole bunch of people that way. Got them to come back. And then basically created an ecosystem. Those people in turn then went and created companies. I'm not saying don't fund companies. You don't have to fund companies.
Right, okay.
Do not have to fund, you know, directly any innovation. You basically fund the education sector, right? Mm. You know, help the education sector grow. And the education sector will figure out, you know, some, you know, ultimately the output from the education sector will, this will not show up immediately.
Yeah,
this will
course.
Take,
of course.
you know, a decade, maybe two decades, right? But you got to make the start, right? And right now,
no point looking back in 20 years' time and saying, "Gee, we should have started in 2019," right?
Yeah. Instead of trying, you know, I mean, the education sector is a revenue generator here because we have students coming here, but I think it's not. I think the focus on, you know, you'd increase, for example, the grants that you give out, right, in the research sector. But before that, you'd actually try to, you know, make again the universities competitive and things like that. Yeah. I mean, there are ways to do it. You'd basically, you know, at a high level, you'd fund the that sector, right, which would in turn create jobs and so on. So it's a net positive for the economy in that sense. So you'd not take money away from anything, right? Mm. And it has, in a way, no direct bearing on the exports, because the exports will still happen, because the exports are happening, because there's demand for those resources.
Right. Interesting. I'd also, personally, I think I've said this before, I'd massively upweight the focus on tourism. I think there's one thing, you know, we can be outcompeted on most things around the world. You know, other people can make medical devices, other people can do ICT research, other people can create companies. You can't create an Uluru or a Great Barrier Reef or a Sydney Harbour or, you know, a New South Wales Outback, a Margaret River. Have I got all the states yet? Probably almost all of them.
Did you forget Tasmania?
Oh, Tasmania. Tasmania wines. There you go. Yeah. I'm going to Tasmania in January, hopefully.
But it's already 12.7% of the export.
So it's already in terms of like the stuff that you can't, like we can't be outcompeted on tourism, right? Yeah, we can be outcompeted on prices. But there's no other Uluru being... Like, it strikes me that's something that kind of is so intrinsically and unquestionably Australian. Not instead of, but as well as. It just strikes me as one thing you can't... You know, someone else can make cheaper widgets. Someone else can invent new stuff. Like, there's no competitive advantage in that. When you've got literally stuff on the ground, in the ground, under the ground, around, you know, under the water. I don't understand why we're not doubling down on the stuff that is genuinely unique.
But I think we do really well on that. Like, I mean, you know, having traveled different parts of the world, I think we do really well in terms of, you know, our facilities are really great. Mm. You know, if you want to go into the water, you have, you know, good safety. You know, in terms of rules, regulations, safety, opportunity, things to see, things to do in terms of, you know, could we have slightly better roads maybe? But, you know, I think tourism is one thing we do really well.
Yeah.
So I mean, I'm, you know, I don't feel,
okay,
I don't find tourism to be lacking.
So the incremental investment's not best spent there, you reckon?
Well, I would not decrease anything that we do.
Right.
But I think we are very high. Like, I mean, you know, you go to places, facilities everywhere. There's a cafe to, you know, an information center. I don't know what else you would do.
You know what I do, mate? I've already been treasurer this episode. I'm going to be tourism minister as well.
Mm.
You know, I reckon the biggest bang for buck, if I could put another couple of dollars in tourism, it would be just clearing up the lines at the airport when you arrive and when you leave. Like, you know how annoying customs is right around the world,
it's
right?
It's not customs. It's quarantine.
But can you imagine? But that all that stuff. Like, can you imagine if you were... It wouldn't cost as much. Right? It costs tens of millions of dollars max, right? And so economically, that's peanuts. Imagine that if you went to, let's pick a country, England. You turn to England, you arrive at the airport, you walk off the plane, and you spend literally 5 minutes going from the plane to the taxi.
Oh, really? Right? You haven't been. Have you been lately there?
It's terrible.
Yeah, like it takes you.
Right. So imagine how you would rave. Imagine you would come back from that and go, you guys have got to go to Heathrow. It was amazing. I had such a great, your very first experience with England is like, oh my God, this is amazing.
Mm.
That sets up your entire holiday.
But you know what I'll say?
Tell me.
To that, anybody who goes to Sydney and then goes to Heathrow, I'm going to say, I'm going to go to Sydney again and again and again.
Because
it takes, like, I mean, you know, our airport is not like the most, Sydney airport is not like the most splashy, but it's incredibly efficient. Like,
I know.
Incredibly efficient. We've got all these machines. You can actually, you know, swipe your passport in the machine.
Cool, huh?
I love coming back into Sydney from any other airport because I know it's going to be very quick, right? So, I, you know, the only thing I've always, the only issue I've found is like after a long flight, every flight is long here, right? Like
exactly.
If you're coming internationally, every flight is long.
You can't do a short flight, right?
There's no short flight, unless you're going to New Zealand or something, but, you know, that's the shortest.
Yeah.
Well, it's the quarantine line, but you know, again, that's there for reasons. I don't know what you could do. You can maybe put like more lines.
That's what I do.
There.
I triple staff. Maybe you're right. I just reckon if first impressions count, we all know they do.
Mm.
If you arrive in Sydney, you go, man, that was amazing. You're already in such a good mood when you get through the airport. The rest of the trip's probably going to be a good one. Rather starting off with like I had to wait in the quarantine line for 25 minutes. It was kind of crappy. And I needed to go to the toilet. I couldn't use my phone. And
I'm yet to find one tourist who I know who has hated coming to, you know, whose experience has been bad. I mean, what I'm saying is that our experience is actually pretty good. Is there an opportunity to make it better? Maybe. But we're already in terms of like the big metropolis airport, like, I don't, you know, like, yeah, pick LAX.
Oh, man. Don't pick LAX.
Right?
That is literally the worst airport in the world.
Like, you know, when you have to actually change your terminal, you don't know. You're like, nobody knows where to go.
When I fly to the US, mate, because we go to the East Coast more often than not to world headquarters of Full HQ, I always fly in via Dallas, and it is just, it is such a worthwhile difference.
Yeah, and they've got that automatic train thing that helps.
Oh, they do too. Yeah, they do.
Yeah.
We're massively
tangent.
Let's go.
Motley Fool Money. Financial advice for real people, not trust fund hippies. Sign up for the newsletter at fool.com.au/MMM.
All right, mate. Mailbag time. And we had a question from Nam. Nam says, "Hi, Scott and Doc. I believe you're a holder of Webjet shares. Would love to hear your thoughts on the recent weakness and Webjet's long-term potential." Now, I am a holder of Webjet shares, so Nam's correctly picked me up there. But rather than me answering, Doc, I want to hear your thoughts first up. Because, you know, again, it's a hard question. I'm biased, right, because I own the shares. So what do you think of Webjet's recent weakness and long-term potential?
So, you know, Nam probably missed the episode where I just got worked up about Webjet.
I'm just giving you another chance, Matt, that's all.
So, okay. So Webjet is a hard one to understand. They actually had really good results. Mm-hmm. The valuation looks really attractive, and the shares are basically down.
Yeah. And you were worked up because during earnings season, lots of crappy stuff went up.
Yeah.
Webjet had some good results, probably even very good, I think it's fair to say. Oh, I didn't own them then, by the way, so I'm claiming no credit. And the shares went down, and you were a little nonplussed.
I'm still nonplussed in the sense that, okay, so the one cloud that's there is the Thomas Cook. Just to clarify here, I'm going to get a little into the weeds here. So Webjet has a business which is basically a B2B business, yes, where they basically provide services. Essentially, or not really services, but they're basically buying certain number of, you know, I got beds and things like that from other people.
So think about a whatif.com or a lastminute.com.au. These guys provide a service that kind of enables that back end to work, mostly in Europe and the Middle East.
Yeah, but it's also like, you know, it's like getting, like, you know, so there's the beds business, right?
Yes.
Yeah, so the
web beds.
Web beds. So it's basically like, you know, you could buy in bulk from certain hotels or some hotel chains, a bunch of, like, for example, rooms, right?
Yep.
And then you sell them to somebody else.
Mm-hmm.
So now the Thomas Cook bankruptcy is going to impact their numbers.
Yes.
Right.
Now, Thomas Cook is not, so we kind of know Thomas Cook, the name. In the UK, it is so dramatically huge. They even have their own, or they had their own aeroplanes. This was a very, very large tourism business. Aeroplanes, hotels, bookings, travel agent, like this really vertically integrated kind of behemoth that went literally stone motherless broke.
Yeah, like they basically have charter aircrafts and things like that. That, you know, they're basically they're like a holiday, like people, like they're a holiday.
It's kind of like a cruise liner, but with an airplane instead, right?
Yeah. So it's kind of like, yeah, it's like Carnival Cruise, but for the planes.
Yeah.
So they went broke, and they're actually one of the oldest, or probably the oldest British travel company. That went broke. Mm. So Webjet had a business with them. That's going to be impaired. There's some stuff, or not, I shouldn't say impaired, but rather they're not going to get the earnings that they're projected to get from them.
Correct.
Or the commissions. And there's certain things, certain amount of monies that have been due, which they may not get paid, or probably are not going to get paid.
Almost certainly not going to get paid, yep.
Okay. Almost certainly they're not going to get paid. Irrespective of that, I think when the announcement, this is recently, relatively recently, you know, they have basically said that this B2B business is still growing at 50% in the 10 weeks past the announcement.
So it's going to hurt, but they're still growing.
They're still 50%.
That's all right.
That's nothing to sneeze at. So I don't know. There's a lot of pessimism around Webjet is what I can see.
Is it too much focus on, I'm leading the witness here because I own the shares, but is it too much focus on the short term? Is that the market simply just not appreciating the long-term opportunity and over-focusing on the short-term risks?
Yeah, so I mean, if I have to put a reason, which is always hard to do, you know, it could be that the market is thinking, well, you know, growth in travel is related to growth in the economies. If the economies overall, like, you know, in Europe and so on, are actually not growing that fast, and the economies, you know, we're cutting interest rates because economies are not growing fast.
Mm-hmm.
All of those things have an impact on travel. But, you know, what that means is oftentimes these can also be an opportunity for the nimble players, the smart players, to actually take market share, right?
Yeah, fair.
And a company like Webjet could do it. So, but there's a lot of pessimism around it. But at what, a PE of 20 or something like that? Again, I'm making that up on the top of my head. Last time I checked, so somewhere around that. Earnings growth of 30%. Let's say when the earnings growth drops to like 15%, that still seems like a pretty reasonable bet. I mean, I really like the price point. And yeah, so is it all clear sailing? No, but nothing is clear sailing. This is a pretty, in my books, it's a pretty good company that is selling for a good price.
Yep. Now, Mike won't do better than that other than to say we don't really care about short-term weakness in the share price per se. We like almost entirely ignore that stuff. Other than to the extent it maybe makes us look, as we just have, and said, well, what's going on and what do we think the value is? So we're not led by the market from that perspective, but we do just make sure we understand what the market's thinking and maybe why things don't look as bright as maybe they did in the past to the market, but our long-term thesis largely unchanged. Any short-term issues from Thomas Cook are probably overdone by the market. I think it's fair to say, at least from my perspective.
Yeah, I as I said, you know, again, I got really worked up after the earnings. So
you're still coming down.
I'm still coming down, but yeah, it's a good company. It's a growth company available at actually a good price. So yeah, I think it's a good one.
Mate, the next question we had was from Samuel. Now Samuel told us we were the epitome of self-directed financial education, if I remember correctly, which was a lovely way to start. And so this time he starts with, "Hey lads, podcast's okay, I guess." Now, I did chip him about that, and he said it was just had to balance that out. So I guess that's fair for now. Well, Samuel, we'll let you through on your last ebullient commentary recommendation. Just make sure you don't get too far off track. Just make sure the next one's another positive one, please. He says, just had a question about ETFs. Do you think it's important to include an ETF that covers small cap stocks? I asked because I was thinking of doing something like, and he mentions three particular Vanguard funds, a global fund, Australian fund, and another one, to cover international, Australia, and emerging. There you go. The other one's emerging stocks. But do you think it's worth having some exposure to small caps specifically? He's got a second question, which I'll hold for a second. Doc, so ETFs, exchange-traded funds, they provide easy, diverse, low-cost access to a whole market or a subset of a market. In this case, Samuel's got Australian, global developed, and effectively global emerging. So that's pretty much the entire world in three ETFs, which we're big fans of. Should he, though, be specifically trying to add some sort of small cap exposure?
Well, this is a hard one to answer again, because as someone who runs a small cap newsletter, what do I say? You know, here's the thing, right?
No pressure, mate, but your job's on the line.
Exactly. So okay. The small caps have the opportunity of providing high returns.
Yes.
Right? They come with higher risk. Mm-hmm. And that's the flip side. I would not do small caps. I mean, I think the small caps is probably not a good place to use an ETF, largely because, you know, your small cap ETFs typically will have several thousand companies. Effectively, it gets really watered down and it's hard. I mean, small caps, I think I would suggest that you look at individual companies and buy them.
Yep.
And you know, there should be like a subset of your portfolio, and if you've got these ETFs and then you're building a service. And should you have it or not is really an individual question. It depends on the type of investor you are, your tolerance for volatility, you know, your stage of life, and so on and so forth. I invest a lot in smaller companies, and you know, I'm okay with that volatility. Should you or shouldn't you is like, you know, it's basically like, should I buy large cap?
Yeah.
You know, again, I would not tell anyone to do anything that they don't feel comfortable doing, right? You have to first feel comfortable investing in small cap, realizing that there are the upsides, and the balance that with the things that come with it, like volatility is, for example, going to be there. There's going to be, you know, higher chances of losing more funds versus with, you know, like a blue chip company, for example. So I can't really specifically answer that.
Mate, you're our resident small cap high growth guru, so I'm going to defer to you on the individual stock selection question. Sam, the only thing I would probably add is that to some degree, the small caps, by their very nature, are very hard for an ETF to own in decent sizes because, you know, if you think about a small cap company, it's $100 million worth of market cap, for example. It's very, very hard for a Vanguard or someone similar to own meaningful chunks of that without kind of it's just very hard to kind of access those stocks. They don't trade all that often. There's normally a big gap between the asking price and the offer price. So it's a bit hard for them to own meaningful amounts of it. So they tend not to. Transaction costs are also higher for the same reasons. Here's my thing. If we're going to buy an ETF, you're buying for, market-wide diversification to get roughly the average market return. And that's, you're going to get that with an ETF. Individual small cap stocks aren't going to, in and of themselves as a separate sector, owned in proportion, which is what an index fund would do. If you have, you think about the ASX, right? The ASX 200 and the All Ords, they're effectively the same index. They go roughly together. One might slightly outperform the other depending on what's going on. But overall, the next level from the 200 to the All Ords, about 300 companies, it's probably like, I want to say 2 or 3%, maybe a little bit more, but not much, of the ASX 200, all the market weighters in the top. So if you're going to own it in proportion, you'd kind of, the investment would be reasonably, in fact, very small and probably not worth owning. And by the time they get to decent-sized companies, then you can pick them up then. So I reckon if you're an ETF investor, you just don't need access to small caps. Now, that being said, we think that stock picking is worth doing. And so if you're going to do that, buy Doc's newsletter and get a chance to buy some of those small cap stocks. But I would say buy small caps, absolutely. I just don't know whether, if you're an ETF investor, I don't know that small caps are necessarily worth the time, cost, and hassle.
Yeah.
Now, Sam asked a second question about Michael Burry. Now, for those who have seen the movie The Big Short, Michael Burry is the somewhat eccentric character, drummer, who in the movie, if you remember it, who took a big, big bet against the housing market and was wrong and wrong and wrong and wrong and wrong until he was finally and substantially right, spectacularly right, and then closed his fund because the stress of running it was just way too much. It's one of those things where even when you're right, you don't get to be popular. Burry has come out recently, Doc, and said that ETFs are an asset bubble, or similar words. He's concerned that to some degree, the fact that ETFs are passive, that may lead to market distortions and maybe there's too much money in those ETFs. Now, in the past, it's not been great to disagree with Michael Burry. I'm going to outright disagree with him. There is absolutely no reason I'm aware of, and he may well know more than me, no reason I'm aware of why ETFs should either add to or subtract from any sort of market volatility or market performance. If you're literally tracking the index moves as the way the index moves. There's no reason if they're reasonably and appropriately priced, why in the fullness of time, there's always going to be short-term volatility. There's no reason in the fullness of time why an ETF should behave any differently to the index itself. And if that's true and the index itself is going to give you roughly average market returns, I don't see what there is to be scared of.
Yeah, I'm not sure either. I'll just say that, I'm not sure either. I don't pay attention to, there are a lot of people with a lot of opinions and, I have a small list of people.
You have a big list of people.
Well, there's a small list of people that I think that here's the problem, right? Somebody could be famous for making one call.
Yep.
Does that mean that I need to listen to them because they made that one famous call? Maybe I do, maybe I don't.
Right.
But Michael Burry is not one of those people that I actually have actively, what is he saying, what is he thinking? I don't actually pay attention to that. I mean, to my detriment maybe, but, I figure that there are so many, everybody has an opinion. Yep. Everybody's on social media. Even I am on social media. And I have like lots of opinion, right? So I just look at myself and say, well, I have an opinion. I just woke up and I just decided to tweet something. Well, is it worth my, I'm belittling myself. But I mean, that's the thing. All got little small amounts of time that we have to apportion. And I have a preference to listen to what thinkers are saying.
Yeah.
And when I say thinkers, I mean people who think deep, who actually have, innovative contributions that they're making. And I like to listen to what they are saying instead of, what Michael Burry is saying about, I don't know, and with no disrespect to Michael Burry, I just don't follow him. So I have no clue.
You're a scientist by background too. And I think this is important. The economics is called the dismal science for lots of good reasons, including this one. There is no scientific study around the world that would simply say, hey, this guy was right once. Let's do what he thinks.
Yeah.
I mean, there's big enough issues with sample sizes of tens or hundreds.
Yeah.
When someone makes one call and gets it right, then, hey, he was right. And maybe that means he might be right again. But there's simply, economics, journalism, I think we all tend to fall for that idea of like so-and-so said something and so-and-so was right. Or frankly, it's just a big outlandish claim. And Steve Keen is a lovely bloke and super, super well-meaning and believes deeply in his views. But he's been wrong for about 15 years and we're still talking about it. At some point, you know, it's reasonable to kind of put that aside and say, well, yeah, he may, you know, there's no other part of science, and economics doesn't claim to be science. Certainly scientists don't believe economics is science, but there's no part of science that would even go anywhere near that sort of performance, say, therefore we should pay any more than average random chance to that view.
Yeah, and I think that's a good point. I think the main thing is that if people have made that one call, it's mostly with negative calls, right?
Yeah.
Which is really hard. Like, you know, there are people who are famous for, oh, that person predicted that Enron is going to go bankrupt and therefore I should listen to it. But if you look at that person's fund, then you might find something else that's happening. I do listen to people who have long track records of super successful, for example, investing, right? And that can be useful because you can learn something there, right? There too, I mean, there's the question, like, you know, past record is not a guarantee of future success, right? I mean, you got to be skeptical and think, but at least it's a good, to me, a long record of something that proves has the potential of proving something is a good starting point. But, you know, if you've got one successful call for something that made you famous, I mean, I think everybody should remember that RBS made this really famous call, which is, you know, go find it on your favorite search engine, Bing.
Single samples, go.
Yeah, so on Bing.com, you can search for RBS January 2016,
yes.
Sell everything. So now,
that was a good call.
Well, if this call was true, right? If this call actually passed,
right? Yes. Yes.
Then what would happen? That every time, you know, we'll all be subscribed to the RBS Twitch channel.
Well, mate, in a parallel universe, Michael Burry is a nobody, and RBS are the geniuses who correctly called the 2016 crash.
Exactly. And I mean, no disrespect. I mean, those people who wrote that report definitely believed what they wrote, right? Yep. I mean, I'm not saying that they didn't believe it.
You don't put that sort of stuff out unless you believe it.
Yeah, like, I mean, you have to believe it, right? And, you know, like, so sometimes the problem is what you believe may not come to pass because the world just doesn't work that way.
Correct.
Right.
Mate, we've got a question from Nick. Nick says, hi, guys. Your podcast continues to surprise, and the addition of the mega mailbox was a masterstroke. That's very kind, Nick, and the check's in the mail. Question, I'm with the online stockbroker Self Wealth. Try saying that five times quickly. Is it just this one that basically ignores reinvested dividends in their return calculations? Not in the trade history, no notification, no running total return, DRP amounts excluded from the holding total gain, just visible in the end of year reporting. Is this a strange thing not to highlight for an online broker, or am I unique in this observation? Is the answer quick, Nick? You are not alone. The brokers don't do any of that sort of stuff. They don't tend to track portfolio level returns at all. They tend to track basically position returns. In fact, most of them you actually put in your own cost base. They simply don't choose to, try to, or bother giving you that sort of result. They basically say, hey, what did you buy for it? What did you buy it for? Here's the current price. That's all they'll basically give you as a return.
Yeah, like, I mean, the best I've seen from brokers is basically you get a year-to-date return. I mean, that includes everything.
But if you cash in, cash out, it gets a bit messy. Like, they just don't try and do that.
Yeah, see, if you have cash in, cash out, then they might try to. I mean, it becomes messy. Yeah, so it's, a broker's job is not to actually provide you investment return calculations. If you want to do it, it's actually relatively straightforward to do it in using a spreadsheet. You know, you can just, if you just know when cash came in, and when cash went out, and you know that today, the value today, you can just use a spreadsheet again.
Is it the XIRR calculation?
Yeah. Use the XIRR. I would begrudgingly tell people to use that on Google Spreadsheet. It's easy to do it.
I've never heard you say that in your entire life, Doc.
Begrudgingly, because it's very simple to do it. But you could also do it on Excel if you want to do it. You can do it on Numbers if you want to do it.
There we go.
On Google Spreadsheet, you can actually very easily do it. It's very straightforward, very easy, and that basically just gives you money-weighted annual returns, basically.
In fact, Nick, I would go one step further, and I would say you probably should use Doc's approach. Position by position is useful, but it kind of at some level isn't overly beneficial at some point. Now, you kind of have to track something. Some of our services, we do track position by position because there's no other real way to do it. On our portfolio services, though, while we do show the kind of return on a stock level, you know, just because we kind of, again, want to be transparent, the total portfolio number is much, much, much more useful. And so whether it's a DRP where the dividend goes to buy back something else, different stock or a different, you know, use, you know, different use for the cash, if the money goes in, comes out, I would encourage all of our listeners, yes, absolutely understand what your companies are doing, because that helps you learn some lessons about what to do more of or do less of. But the total portfolio level is so much more useful for calculating performance, because that gives you a real number. Whether Woolies paid a dividend that I bought Coles shares with, or Coles paid a dividend that I bought Woolies shares with, or you know, vice versa, you're much, much better off knowing how your capital allocation is going in total, rather than tracking the position by position. It might not be a great answer or a very attractive answer. That's the answer I think is the best one.
Yeah.
Last question, mate, from Rowan. Rowan says, "G'day, Scott. Loyal listener here in Budapest, Hungary." We've got two Hungary listeners. John is another regular correspondent from Hungary, so maybe you blokes should get together, have a beer, and put your foolish jester caps on and have a bit of fun. He says, "My favourite podcast for 3 years, as it keeps me in tune with Aussie companies back home and is a small pill for homesickness." Mate, just quietly, if you think this is what Australia's about, you've really got to get out more. Maybe too much time in Budapest has taught you that, don't expect it to be exactly like this podcast when you get back. He says, "I would like to vote for 2 shows a week, as the mailbag is killer." I'm going to assume that means in a good way. Is that fair?
Well, hopefully.
"You're often covering companies in Oz and US, but rarely do you mention European companies. Curious if you have any investments in the Europe or the UK, and if any are on your watch list." Same question for Doc. I'll move on in a second. That's the first question, mate. I have no European companies at all in my portfolio, basically for a couple of reasons, but largely because there's only a limited amount of investable universe time and effort I can spend researching. And my general preference is to look at Australia and the US and US listed companies. But there's an important one here, because most US companies, in fact, these days earn more of their revenues outside the US than inside. So to some degree, from my mind, we're not getting every company on the US exchanges, but the US companies are a pretty good proxy for global access. There are some really, really great companies that simply aren't on the US exchange, and I know I'm missing out on those. I simply don't have enough research time to devote to multiple exchanges. And so I've kind of made a deal with myself that if Australia is 2% of the world's markets and the US is 60%, well, in 2 exchanges, that's not a bad starting place. How about you?
Yeah, I think something very similar. One of the things is I tend to focus on tech businesses. So if I have to look at overseas companies, mm-hmm. then most of those tech businesses, interesting tech businesses that I find, majority happen to be listed in the US. They might not all be US companies, right? Mm-hmm. You know, but there are companies that basically, you know, they could be even French companies, or they could be other European companies, and right. they just happen to be listed in the US, or their primary listing actually is in the US, yep, right?
Or yep. We'll have secondary listings. So either way, you can normally access most if you want to through a US exchange.
So that's that. And So as you said, that most companies have international revenues, and if they've got international mm-hmm. revenue, that international revenue basically covers Europe. So for that reason, I don't look specifically at.
Yep.
And then if there's like, you know, again, everybody has limited, you know, if I've got limited investable cash and, mm-hmm. you know, I'm looking at having like 30, 40 odd companies, it's just something that doesn't, you know, come in my radar. That said, if somebody pointed me that this is a very awesome European company that, you know, I should invest in, then I would have a look. And, you know, if I liked it, I would invest. There's nothing that says I wouldn't invest in it, but it's just one of those things that I've not looked at.
Much better answer than mine, mate. Thank you. Rowan goes on to say, "When it comes to cheap ways to transfer money in different currencies, I'm surprised you haven't mentioned any of the new fintechs, such as TransferWise, that offer you a borderless account and debit card." Now, I'm going to assume Rowan doesn't work for TransferWise or is not a shareholder undeclared. So, Rowan, feel free to tell us and disclose if you are, but we'll assume you're not. He says, "This way you can move money between currencies 6 times cheaper and way faster than banks. It also gives you transfers between currencies within seconds. Very handy when shopping online and beating cheeky exchange rates. It's an interesting story how this company started up, which I can relate to being an expat." So for those out there, if you want to have a look at TransferWise, we're not recommending it directly. We haven't looked into it ourselves in any significant detail. But if you are interested, and that's something that's on your radar, we thought we'd just pass that on from Rowan. Thank you, mate, for sharing that. And then he ends with, and that brings me to my second question. "Can you share any companies you would be excited to see on the list on the market with an IPO, and you won't hesitate to get in as soon as they do? Thanks, and keep up the good work, Rowan." All right, mate, so are there any companies, private companies here or overseas, you're just itching to jump on as soon as they list?
So there are a lot of great companies, right? but I would, okay, so the most important thing here would be the price, right? So if I'm, for example, itching to buy something and I think it's a great price, I'm sure there'll be other people itching to buy something and it'll just be bid up. So that's the part of the problem. Yeah, like, you know, if I could, like, for example, own a piece of SpaceX, I might consider it. Airbnb, I might consider it. These are interesting businesses. But again, without looking at what, you know, before the IPO, they'd have to release a document in their prospectus that's going to basically release their financials. And then we'll learn a lot more than what we learn from the press. So I think, yeah, I think when a company is private, we probably just hear the good side, unless they have, you know, the bad story is leaking out.
Well, that's true, right? Because all you see is kind of the consumer facing or the business facing kind of experience with the company.
Yeah.
And that can be wonderful. It doesn't necessarily make it a quality business. And certainly, without wanting to cast aspersions, the likes of Uber have been caught short. WeWork itself looked like a wonderful business, or at least for some people, until the CEO had to step down and there were some shenanigans going on there that were kind of brought to light. There's a whole lot of stuff that maybe separates a good consumer experience or a good business experience from a great company or even then a great investment. And the difference between those two, of course, is the price.
Yeah. The one thing I'll add is actually IPOs are interesting when the company is actually flying under the radar. So it's often, that's interesting because there are not too many people interested in it.
Is that code if you're not going to tell us the ones you're thinking of because you don't want us to know?
But, you know, I mean, we've recommended a couple of times, you know, like, we recommended Elmo soon after it IPO'd, right? I mean, again, it was an under the radar company.
The
at
HR
that time.
Company, not the Sesame Street character, right?
Yeah, HR software company out here on the ASX.
Yes.
And you know, like, it was under the radar. People, you know, not many people followed it. Mm. You know, it had good growth rates, good opportunities, had an interesting business strategy. So those sort of things are interesting. I think on the other side, like as I said, I would, if I could own a piece of Airbnb, I might be, but I don't know what price it is and I don't really know what the financials look like. So
other than that though,
I mean, it sounds like, you know, hey, I own a piece of Airbnb. This is an awesome thing that everybody is interested in. It sounds good from that point of view.
Fair to say the companies we're interested in, but not necessarily investments we would make sight unseen. And we don't want people to look at that and say, great, as soon as it lists, I'm going to buy some because Scott and Doc said it was worth buying. We're saying there are some great companies out there, interesting companies, and given the right circumstances and the right information, we may well be interested.
I think that's fair to say.
A couple for me, mate. Steam is an interesting business that is basically a private business that allows you to, on your computer, aggregate and buy gaming, so computer games effectively. Really nice subscription business, high usage. That's an interesting one for me. I'd be pretty keen to have a look at that. Others that are private, nothing else in mind that I kind of would love to jump on. I'm a later post-IPO buyer than you probably are, mate. I generally, as a broad rule, rules are always meant to be broken, but as a broad rule, would want about at least 12 months of public market experience before I buy. That's not for everybody, but for me, that's a decent rule of thumb I try and use, just because, to the point of those shenanigans, there is, you know, we know a little bit about some stuff that's private and not well known. When something lists, we know a little bit more about it, and then 12 months later on the markets, we get to see two reporting periods, a bit more kind of just kind of, you know, business as usual reporting. That tells us a little bit more. If I've been burnt investing in the past and a couple of times, it's been buying post-IPO, where frankly the post-IPO performance and the pre-IPO performance was very good, but fell off a cliff really quickly. And I probably, had I waited a little bit longer, I might have saved myself some grief. Now, on the flip side, there's also opportunities where that is worth doing. So I'm not suggesting it's always a bad thing, but for me, I wouldn't be rushing into anything at IPO. I can't imagine buying anything at all, actually, as it lists, unless I was super excited about it or for some reason love the idea. I'd almost always wait 12 months before buying. Any more for you, mate?
No.
Mate, we've gone well over time.
I think so. I think this is it.
Is anyone still listening?
No.
If you are still listening, let us know. Doc, you mentioned social before, so I'm going to give us a quick plug before we go, because we love hearing from our listeners, and from what we know, our listeners love chatting with us. So if you want to hit us up, get ready for the roll call. We'll start with Instagram, because I normally start the other way around. If you're on Instagram, send us an Insta question. Like our post, don't send us a food pic. Please don't send us a food photo. And I don't want us any kind of...
Send some coffee photos to Scott.
Don't send us coffee photos.
Even better, send him dog photos. He loves dogs.
The Fool account is at The Motley Fool AU on Instagram. I'm at TMF Scott P. That's Instagram if you're there. If you're on Twitter, you can hit Doc up at Anirban Mahanti. You can hit me up at TMF Scott P. Again, The Motley Fool at The Motley Fool AU. If you're on the Twitters, let us know. And if you're on Facebook, unlike Doc, who, if he does tweet, tends to tweet about negative Facebook stories. If you're on Facebook, is that true?
Definitely true.
If you're on Facebook, at The Motley Fool Australia or at Scott Phillips Money, you can get us on all of the socials. We're not on Wii, Snap, Tinder, Chat or anything because we're just not that cool. But everything else, all the mainstream channels we're on, and get us up. If you need to email us, if you aren't a social person, I understand, info@fool.com.au is the best way to get to us, and those questions will make their way to our dulcet ears and your... Well, you'll hear our dulcet tones, not dulcet ears. You get the idea. Mate, I'm probably done. That wraps us up. Before we go, don't forget you can and should subscribe to this podcast through iTunes or your favourite Android podcast app. It is Triple M Motley Fool Money. Check it out. And if you like what we're doing, give us a rating, leave us a review, tell your friends, because, hey, the more the merrier. And you can get a dose of foolishness straight to your inbox. It's our favourite bit. By going to fool.com.au/Triple M.
Triple M.
That's it for this week's Motley Fool Money. We'll be back next week with another dose of foolish insight. Fool on.
Fool on.
The Motley Fool and people appearing in this program may have positions in the companies mentioned. General advice only. Please speak to your financial professional to understand how it may pertain to your situation. Subscribe to the free newsletter at fool.com.au/triple M. The Motley Fool operates under Financial Services License 400691.